impression?
Oh, I think I was impressed that they were very complex machines, which they are, of course, and that I didn't really want to serve in them. They didn't win me over at first sight, but I found myself in them without even trying later on, not knowing what I was in for. But all the same, it was interesting to see it, and the petty officer was really decent, and I thought I gave him a rather unkind answer. When he said, "Are you thinking of joining boats, sir?" I said, "No, not me." And I realised later on that was a stupid answer, because obviously he liked submarines, and that's what he's there, and my answer indicated that I disliked them. Well, that wasn't a very kind way to act after he'd spent an hour of his time showing me around.
We'll talk about that too. But in relation to the progress of the war up until the time that the Japanese were to enter, things weren't looking particularly hot for the Allies.
No, they weren't.
What was the situation in relation to your job and how that would...
Well, it was December 1942 that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
41,
yes.
Up until that time, I mean, we've got the fall of Greece and Crete and
yes.
in the middle of that year, Syrian campaign,
yes.
about the only good thing happening, really, yes. in many respects, Tobruk's being yes. besieged,
yes.
all of those sorts of
yes.
things.
Yes, well, that didn't affect us directly. We knew what was happening, and it wasn't reassuring, but our own bit of the war, escorting ships up and down between Liverpool and Gibraltar, was not going terribly well either. But in December 41, we'd just been fitted with radar, and that was a convoy I do remember vividly, because we were heading south. When we got opposite Portugal, there were some ships bound for Portugal, and these were dispatched from the main body of the convoy, and Bluebell and another corvette, Carnation, were detailed off to escort these ships to the coast and then to rejoin the convoy. Well, we did this, and we were coming back at night, approaching the convoy, which of course had got pretty well ahead of us, and we were coming back independently from Bluebell and Carnation, and we picked up an echo on the radar, and it turned out to be a U-boat, and we attacked that, and that was my first and only attack on a U-boat, and that was quite exciting. I think now, after many years and a lot of research, particularly when I was writing my book, I obtained the German records, and I believe we sank U-208. It's not definite, because two destroyers had also attacked a U-boat in a similar area a few days before, and between the three of us, U-208 was sunk. And as our attack was after the destroyer attack, I claim that we sank it. All this is pretty well analysed in my book, Corvette and Submarine. But that was good news. But the not so good news was that Japan was now in the war, and our two ships were sunk off from Singapore. Prince of Wales and Repulse, and that was bad. But for all that, it was the beginning of the good time for us, because with America in the war, the U-boat soon found that America was not battle-hardened as Britain was, and the convoy system had yet to been developed. Although Britain had kept America informed blow by blow of how the convoy system was going, and passed all the intelligence onto America, America had to find out for itself, and the U-boats found the American shipping was much much easier target than the the ships that we were escorting. And so you find from the table in the back of my book that from that time we lost no ships. The U-boats all went across to what they called the happy time, to the west side of the Atlantic.
Well, we can talk about that. Your opinion of the extent of U-boat activity. But in relation to sinking U-boats, did you have protocols in place to rescue survivors if any should show?
that was left to the captain. When you sink a U-boat, most times it doesn't come to the surface. It just goes down, stays down. But when they do come to the surface, yes, you try to rescue survivors. But there's a risk, of course, because to rescue survivors, you've got to stop. And while you stop, you're setting target to any other U-boat. And as they hunted in packs, there were always other U-boats around. Nevertheless, we didn't ever rescue any survivors because this one attack we made on U-208, she didn't sink. She didn't come to the surface. She just disappeared. So there were no survivors. But just, we'd have picked them up. And I think the British attitude was all their seamen had lost their ship and they were destitute. They were lucky to survive. And we'd look after them as well as we could. We had limited accommodation in Bluebell. When we rescued our own survivors, that is British survivors, we housed them in the mess deck. But when you rescue enemy sailors, you got to have them under security somewhere. And about the only place is the cable locker. It's right forward where the anchor chain is kept. Not very comfortable up there. But, well, it never happened to us, so we didn't have to make up any decision on that. But I've often thought about this. It'd be pretty tricky. If you could trust an enemy crew to say, look, if you all give us your word that you'll behave yourselves and not continue the war aboard this ship because you are our guests, then we'll give you a bit more comfort. But it'd be a risk doing that because I imagine the hardened Nazis would, they wouldn't give their word or they'd give it and break it. So if it didn't happen to us, we didn't have to do it.
Well, I do get the impression that there is this sort of code of the seamen.
Well, there is.
And how you treat someone at sea, regardless.
Yes, there is. And that's demonstrated these days between the Russians and everybody else. The Russians are not a particularly friendly crowd, but I was very thrilled recently when the British managed to rescue this small Russian submarine that was caught in cables and nets down the seabed. That was a great, great event. Yes, I think we would have treated them decently. When the war's over, you're back as normal world citizens again. I think what I would have said is, look, the war's over for you, so you might as well consider yourself civilians, and if so, we'll treat you with as much comfort as we can provide. That is, the same comfort as we enjoy, which is not very much, but at least you'll be well fed and you kept dry. But it didn't happen.
With the entry of the Japanese into the war, December 7th, 1941, to what degree did you think of Australia?
Well, we thought of it when Japan started to make rapid progress in invading countries to the south and west, that's when we started to worry about Australia, because obviously it was going to be under threat. And nearly all Australians asked about being transferred back to Australia, but we were told to stay put and do as we were told. And I think that was probably a wise thing. So we just carried on doing what we were doing and just hoped that Australia would survive, which it did, but the threat was pretty real. It seemed real at the time. The Japanese have said they had no intention to invade Australia, but we didn't know that then.
They were certainly giving it a go in relation to bombing places like Darwin and Broome,
yes.
Even Sydney Harbour, yes. With mini submarines.
Yes.
Were you to hear any of that news?
Yes, we heard about the attack in Sydney Harbour, but in fact it wasn't a very successful attack. They sank one Manly ferry, Cuttable, and killed some people, but they didn't do any real harm. But I think I accepted our orders to carry on and do our own bit of fighting, and Australia would be cared for, which I suppose it was. You mentioned about living aboard Bluebell and what it was like. I've mentioned a couple of things, but one thing came to mind just a while ago was that one of the main, one of the mundane duties is laundry. Of course, there is no laundry. It's called dobying in the Navy. That's washing your clothes. And I did my own. In some ships, some sailors do dobying to earn a little bit of money. But I did my own, and the procedure was to get a galvanised iron bucket from the galley and put the clothes in it, soak them. There was some soap, and go down to the engine room and ask the watchkeeper if you can get a bit of steam. And he'd probably take you around to a drain, a steam drain, and you put a copper pipe into the bucket, turn on the tap, and you'd hear a lot of bubbling going on, and eventually the water would boil. It was probably pretty rugged treatment for the clothes, never mind. And having got it up to boiling, take it back to the bathroom and give all the clothes a scrub, and then rinse them, and then go back to the boiler room then, to the upper part of the boiler room. There's the funnel uptakes, where we had two boilers, where the flue gases go up to the funnel. There are galleries around there, and it's always warm up there. So we'd go in there and hang our clothes on the handrails. It was fully clean, because we were oil burning, we weren't burning coal, and so you'd get the clothes dry that way. We didn't worry about ironing. I think we had an iron on board, but didn't worry about that too much. The main thing was to keep them clean. So that was one of the things we did in our in-between watches. Now, I can't think of too many other things that reflect on shipboard life. We had a bathroom for the officers, and I used to shave in the bathroom, and I used a cutthroat razor. And they weren't very popular in those days. They're not popular at all now. It's only the barbers that use them. But I used a cutthroat, and the captain came into the bathroom one day while I was scraping away with this evil-looking weapon. He said, "Look out, Sheen." He said, "If you cut your throat, it won't grow again." But the ships are pretty lively, but I could use the cutthroat quite well. In fact, there's only one place I wasn't able to use it, and that was on the train from Perth to Kalgoorlie, the Kalgoorlie Rattler, as it's called, and the 3-foot-6 gauge. That was so rough. I tried to show you for the cutthroat, but it was too dangerous. But everywhere else, in Bluebell all the time, of course, when we were in submarines, we didn't shave on patrol. We shaved when we came back, so we were able to do that all right.
In relation to the experience that you would have had following the entry of the Americans into the war, how quickly was it that submarines took their attention away from you and head off?
It was very quick indeed. It was within weeks that they soon found out. Although it was good for us, we didn't lose any ships. Britain still lost a lot of ships because I've read in a book called Very Special Intelligence that with the move of U-boats over to the Western Atlantic, they were sinking American ships and they were also sinking British ships, because a lot of our ships went across there to bring cargoes back. And the intelligence people in Admiralty got very concerned about this, and so they sent a man called Wynne, who was one of their very bright people, across to America to talk them into getting their convoy technique up to date. And the American said, "Well, mind your own business. You know, this is our war." And he said, "Yeah, but you're losing British ships." And well, eventually they did. One thing about the Americans, they are pretty proud. They like to do everything their own way, but given time, they do it very well. They develop high skill. Of course, they've got enormous industrial potential. And if you read the scores of U-boat kills late in the war, many of them went to American escort carriers. They really had great success there.
How long then was it before you came to be involved in submarines?
It was late 1942, it was September, I think, that I was still in Bluebell, we were doing our north and south run to and from Gibraltar, and every time we hit port, we were issued with a lot of publications. One series was called CAFO, it's Confidential Admiralty Fleet Orders. And there's one, I can't remember the number and date, but I think it's in my book, during about the middle of 1942, which called for volunteers from officers and ratings for special and hazardous service. And it said that volunteers had to be below the age of 24, unmarried, good swimmers, and of strong and enduring physique.